enjoyed thus far in our song service, our prayers, and our fellowship. And what a blessing it is to have these things accrue to us because we are the children of God. If you were studying or have ever studied a course in logic, there is a maxim in logic known as the law of the excluded middle. And what that asserts is that a thing either is or it is not. There's no middle ground. Take a line, for instance. A line is either a straight line or it is not a straight line. It cannot really be partly straight and partly crooked, because if it's that way, then the partly crooked portion would indicate that it's not a straight line. So that's the law of the excluded middle. I want to apply the law of the excluded middle to Christianity tonight in the study that we're going to be making, because Christianity either is of divine origin or it is not. Think of all the religions there are in the world tonight, and I don't really know exactly how many there might be, but let's just say that there are a dozen separate religions in the world. Maybe there are more than that, maybe there are fewer than that. Not all of those religions would claim to be of divine origin. Many of them would readily admit to you that they are the result of the philosophy of some man, and they don't even ascribe to him the status of being an inspired man or a person sent by God or a prophet or some person like that. But when we claim that Christianity is of God, then we are saying that it does not have any human origin at all. If Christianity is not of divine origin, then what's the only other possibility for it? It is of human origin. It's almost like what Jesus asked in the 22nd chapter of Matthew when he asked the Pharisees on that occasion about the baptism of John. He said, now, consider the baptism of John. He said, is this from heaven or is it from men? You remember that question that Jesus raised? He did admit a third possibility. He said the baptism of John is either of heavenly origin or it is of human origin. And of course, they didn't answer the question because they knew that if they should answer it correctly, they would indict themselves. They did not want to say that it was of human origin because all the people regarded John as a prophet, and that would have landed them in hot water with the people that they were trying to have influence over. And so Jesus posed a question like I'm posing tonight. When I say to you, Christianity, is it of divine origin or is it of human origin? Now, if Christianity is simply of human origin, it makes it no better than any other religion. It might as well be one of many human religions that have been originated. And I will tell you that if Christianity is a human religion in its origin, then it is a false religion, because the claims that are associated with it in Scripture is that it is of sacred design. And if Christianity is of God, there ought to be some compelling evidence to support that affirmation. When I talk about Christianity tonight, I am not referring, please understand, to what the world refers to when it speaks of Christianity. I am not referring to Christendom, as sometimes that term will be used to describe every group of people everywhere who claim to be followers of Jesus Christ. When I speak of Christianity, I'm referring to that primitive Christian system which existed in the first century and with which, if we apply diligent attention, we may replicate that same thing today. Of course, minus the miraculous elements that were associated with some of those things in the first century. I am not speaking of the modern version of Christianity. I am not talking about the digressive segments of this large movement in the world known as the Christian faith. And so with that understanding, we have to acknowledge that the influence of the kingdom of Christ is seen It is scattered around the globe, even in those movements that retain but a little bit of the Lord's teaching. We would have to acknowledge that the Lord's influence has been worldwide. So in the discussion that I want to have with you tonight, I want to focus on several factors which would argue for the divine origin of Christianity. Why is it different from other religions? What sets it apart? What evidences are there to suggest that it did not originate with men? Men did not design it. Men did not create it. But it indeed came from the mind and the heart of God Himself. I want to talk with you first of all about several factors that were involved in Christianity's beginning that make it a very unique sort of religion. There are a number of traits that characterized primitive Christianity that demand an explanation if we're going to be able to identify its originating force. So let's consider some of those. When Christianity came on the scene, I hope you understand that it was a brand new religion. There were some people who, at least at first, were confused because they thought that it was just another sect of Judaism. But it came to be very apparent to most people that had any dealings whatsoever with Christianity in its earliest days that the Christian movement was not a movement which had evolved out of the cultural elements of the society in which it was found. Christianity had a dramatic point of beginning. There are no traces of its roots in Assyrian history. There are no traces of its roots in Babylon or Egypt or Greece or Rome. In fact, prior to the spring of the year A.D. 30, Christianity did not exist. It dramatically sprang to life. And it came to life through the influence and the teaching, of course, of Jesus Christ. It had been in a state of intense preparation for more than 3 years that spanned the ministries of two men, John the Baptizer and Jesus of Nazareth, but it came into existence almost suddenly. As a matter of fact, even though the Mosaic system was designed to prepare the way for the coming of Christianity, and that's referenced in Galatians chapter 3, verses 24 and 25, the religion of Jesus was so strikingly different from the religion of the Hebrews that it aroused the hostility of many of the Jews for the first 40 years of its existence until finally Jerusalem itself fell in the year A.D. 70. So from the beginning of Christianity in A.D. 30 till the fall of Jerusalem in A.D. 70, those 40 years were a period of intense persecution by Jews who wanted to stamp out Christianity. But Christianity from the very beginning was a significant religious force, not only in the Mediterranean world, but also in the remote corners of the Roman Empire. Seemingly it had come from nowhere, and yet soon it was absolutely everywhere. I ask you, how did that happen? How did this religion that just seemed to come out of nowhere end up being everywhere? You know, there is another fundamental logical principle that proclaims that every effect must have an adequate cause. And so we ask the question tonight, what's the cause behind the origins of the Christian religion? There has to be some reasonable explanation for the abrupt beginning of this movement devoted to Jesus Christ. And if there is no satisfactory answer to why it originated in a natural cause, then where must we turn in order to get our answer to that question? If we cannot find a natural cause for the beginning of something, then it must have had a supernatural cause as an explanation. For some reason, and nobody can really explain this on an ordinary basis, the religion of Christ exploded on the religious landscape of the first century. Jesus only had a handful of men. He had these 12 apostles who functioned early on as the leaders of His cause. And from that tiny seed came this mighty Christian movement. On the day of its birth, this community of believers consisted of a minimum of 3,000 persons who were baptized on the beginning day in Acts chapter 2 and verse 41. If you think about that number, 3,000, constituting only those that were baptized that day, and not those disciples who had previously been baptized by John the Baptist in anticipation of the coming kingdom, or, as John chapter 4 would point out, even the Lord's disciples, in addition to John the Baptist, had been baptizing people, and they had been helping people come to see what the kingdom was. I would suggest to you that that number 3,000 in Acts chapter 2 is probably just the count for that particular day. But if those others should be added to it, then there were exponentially thousands more people who were involved with this movement. And within a relatively short period of time, in Acts the 4th chapter, the number of the disciples was computed at 5,000 adult men, not to mention the thousands of women who likewise had been added to the body of believers. You might find this interesting, but by the time we get to Acts chapter 7 and verse 60, we read about Stephen, who was martyred for his faith. It has been estimated that at that time the Jerusalem church consisted of no fewer than 20,000 individuals. This represented more than one third of the 55,000 people who were the population of the city of Jerusalem at that time. That's the best estimate and the best records that we're able to come up with, that when the church began, the city of Jerusalem had a 55,000 person population. Now, at Pentecost, that number swelled, obviously, because there were lots of people that came into the city as visitors. But as far as folks who got their mail in the city of Jerusalem, that would have been about 55,000 people. And about 20,000 of those 55,000, by the time Stephen was martyred, had been converted to Christ, according to the best estimates that we can obtain. Beyond that, the gospel rapidly spread. It spread from Palestine into Africa, Acts chapter 8. It spread from Palestine into Syria, Acts chapter 9. These are foreign countries, you see. It spread by the time of Acts 13 into Asia Minor. Finally, by the time of Acts 16, Christianity had spread into Europe. Paul traveled, I don't know if you've ever calculated this, but Paul traveled over 12,000 miles in his career as an evangelist, and he evangelized from Jerusalem to Rome and probably went as far as Spain. At least that was what his planned itinerary would have concluded, according to what he wrote to the Roman church in the 15th chapter and verse 24. Clement of Rome, who was one of the leaders of the church at Rome, he was living at about the year 95 A.D., right there at the beginning point of the second century. He said that Paul actually reached the boundary of the West, and that could, of course, be an allusion to Spain. Both Irenaeus and Tertullian confirmed the presence of Christians in Spain in the second century A.D., and so we must say that even if Paul himself was not able to go, he certainly must have influenced some of his associates to go. And so actually what we have by the second century is that the gospel has spread all across the Mediterranean region. It has gone into Europe. It has gone into Africa. It has gone into Syria. And who knows where else it may have gone. Christianity swept over the Roman Empire like a tidal wave. And the New Testament pays tribute to that phenomenal growth in the book of Acts chapter 17. And verse 6, there's this statement that says that the Christians had turned the world upside down. That was the charge that was made against them. Their effect was obvious, and their sound, according to what Romans 10 verse 18 said, had gone out into all the earth. And in Colossians 1 and verse 6, Paul would say that they were bearing fruit everywhere. I'm asking these questions tonight because it's odd to me that a human movement, simply human in its origin, could do what this movement did as quickly as it did it. Historian Will Durant argued that by the year 300 A.D., a quarter of the eastern segment of the Roman Empire was Christian, while about 1/20 of the western division was identified with Christ. And most scholars today think those figures are way too conservative, based on what we have learned since those historians did their work. A gentleman by the name of E.M. Blakelock has noted that studies of the catacombs, and I know you've probably heard about the catacombs, they were used for a lot of things, but principally, for the Christians at least, they were used as burial places beneath the city of Rome and outside the environs of the city of Rome. If you were to follow all of the galleries of the catacombs as they make their winding way back and forth, they would cover about 600 miles, I'm told. I've not been to them. I've been to Rome, but that's one part of Rome I was not able to visit. But Blakelock says that those catacombs contain somewhere between 1¾ and 4 million Christian graves. He estimated that in the Middle Empire, at least 20% of Rome's citizenry was made up of Christians, and that there were times when the population of Christians was even greater. Now, I understand that many of those tombs, those graves of the catacombs, reflect an association with the Christian cause, though obviously some of the people who were buried there had digressed from the original forms of Christianity and were not as pristine in their faith as were the apostles and those early disciples. But I will tell you that those catacombs in the city of Rome represent about 10 generations of believers. That's the period of time over which those places were being used and were actively being used, and primarily being used by people who claim to be associated with the Christian faith. And so that would suggest, if you calculate that, that the city of Rome itself had somewhere between 175 to 400,000 Christians that lived during those times. And to me, that is absolutely staggering. I'm just using estimates that smart men, not a farm boy, came up with. I have no way of proving any of this, but what I am suggesting to you is that those who do know how you calculate such things in antiquity are telling us that there was a significant movement of Christians far greater than any of us may have ever imagined. Tertullian, who was a believer himself and lived between and did most of his work between the years 160 and 220 A.D., this testimony he gives is pretty dramatic. He said, "Men proclaim that the state," meaning the Roman Empire, "is beset with us." He said, "Every age, every condition, every rank is coming over to us. We are only of yesterday, but already," he said, "we fill the world." And that was his estimation in the year 160 A.D., that Christianity had exponentially grown. The wildfire growth that they had was achieved under awful persecution. You're aware of that. The question, I think, cries out for an answer. What caused this? Was Christianity just another religion that popped up? Was it just another of many religions that the world has seen, that a group of men got together and foisted off on an unsuspecting public? To what may we attribute the cause of this amazing growth? Are there any natural circumstances that would account for this? If there are no natural circumstances that would account for it, then there must be a supernatural cause. And there is another powerful fact that might be mentioned briefly just here. You know, the initial impact of the gospel was only with Jewish communities. That is where the gospel was first preached, as you well know. When the gospel was first heralded, the Gentiles were not included at the very beginning. The nucleus of the early church, of course, was Hebrew. People were converted out of synagogues. Sometimes entire synagogues were converted to Christ. But there were many thousands of Jews who converted to Christianity. It's an indisputable historical fact, however, that the Jews were very strict monotheists, and to them there was but one God. And yet, without controversy, is the fact that Jesus made the claim of being God. Jesus made the claim of being deity. And only the strongest sort of evidence would persuade a Jewish mind to accept the humble Nazarene as God. I think we ought to be impressed with just what it took for those Jews of the first century to be converted to Christ and to come to the point where they could admit that He was God in the flesh. I want you to consider the fact that if you were establishing a religion like Christianity, that maybe one of the most unlikely places that you would begin would be where Christianity began. Think about the place from which Christianity took its rise. This movement was established, of course, in the city of Jerusalem, in a rather obscure country that was, by the secular world at that time, known as Palestine. I guess you might know the origin of the word Palestine. It came from the same word from which you get the word Philistine or Philistine. But it was applied as a title to the area of Judea by the Emperor Hadrian. The Roman Emperor Hadrian began to call the area of Judea Palestine in about the year 135 A.D. Palestine hardly merited any attention at all as a world-class place or a world-influencing place at the first century world of which it was a part. This tiny land was only about 150 miles from its northern border to its southern extremity. Its widest part would really only encompass about 45 to 60 miles, depending on where you might measure that. The land encompassed about 10,000 square miles. It was actually smaller than our state of Massachusetts. And this is where it all began. Not exactly the hot spot of the world. Not exactly the place where you would want to do something big and great that everybody around the world would even notice. In the year 63 BC, the Roman commander Pompey conquered Jerusalem and the Jews came under the invincible grip of Rome. And in fact, it was a grip that they never relinquished. Jerusalem never recovered from the grip of Rome. And the Jews never became an independent nation once Rome had hold of them. The Jews of the first century were a rather violent people. They were a suppressed and oppressed people, and they were aggravated to the max because they had had their freedom and their independence taken from them, and they had become so dangerous that in the year 49 and 50, a reference that's made actually in Acts, the 18th chapter and verse 2, Claudius Caesar decided that the Jews were such a problem and were so terroristic that he expelled 20,000 Jews from the city of Rome. Didn't even want them around because he considered they were too great of a security risk. You see, the Jews operated with this disillusioned expectation of a political Messiah that was going to come along and overthrow the iron fist of the Romans. And they were looking for a Messiah that would reestablish an Israel that would be reminiscent of David's era. There were bands of Hebrew terrorists known as the Sicarii, which in the Latin meant dagger men. In other words, they were just terrorists by our definition, who lay in wait all over the place looking for any opportunity that they could to attack Romans and to try to get rid of the oppression of the Romans. They roamed the land looking for anybody from Rome because they considered all Romans their enemies and they wanted to kill as many, of course, as they possibly could. So in a word, Palestine, where Christianity began, was a smoldering explosive. It was a land that was ready to ignite at any moment. Could any ordinary man who was seeking to establish a purely spiritual movement possibly be successful at doing that in such a volatile environment? Our point is simply this. This was a most contentious time. Palestine was a most unlikely place from which to produce the world's most influential religion. How were they able to accomplish that? It wasn't the effort of man that accomplished that. There was something greater that was the impetus behind this movement. I want you to think for just a few moments about the leader of this movement, our Lord Jesus Christ. Jesus was, of course, viewed as a leader from a purely humanistic point, a rather poor leader, because Jesus did not possess any of the traits that would normally be associated with the formation of an empire or the formation of a mass army. For one thing, he was not a physically appealing character. You want to get elected to national office in our country, it helps if you are nice looking, by the way. And in the Bible, in the book of Isaiah, the 53rd chapter and verse 2, of the Messiah, Isaiah prophesied that he has no stately form or majesty. This is the New American Standard translation. He has no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. Jesus was not somebody that you would pick out of a crowd because he just stood head and shoulders above everybody and he was the best looking guy in the room. He would probably have been somebody that if you had met him, you would have just skipped over him. You would have just not noticed him. He would have faded into the mass of humanity because there was nothing spectacular about his image. There's not one line really in the New Testament about his physical appearance. Not one thing. I've looked high and low trying to figure out what would a New Testament writer say about the physical appearance of Jesus, and I can't come up with a single line. The closest I get is this passage in Isaiah, where he just simply says he was just nobody that was special as far as his appearance was concerned. Many of you in this audience will remember General Douglas MacArthur, and there was a biography written a number of years ago about General MacArthur titled The American Caesar, Douglas MacArthur. And when Manchester wrote that book, he referenced materials over and over again to the stately appearance of that very famous World War II commander. In fact, he took over 70 pages, I understand, to describe what an appearance this man had on various occasions in various places. But apparently there wasn't anything in the physical deportment of Jesus to merit anybody's attention. Nobody paid attention to Jesus because he was a stunning figure, or he was somebody that you would immediately take notice of when he walked into a room. Napoleon recognized that. I want to read something to you that Napoleon Bonaparte wrote in his famous speech when he was on St. Helena, the island to which he was actually banished. He says, "I know men, and I want to tell you that Jesus Christ is not a man." He said, "Superficial minds see a resemblance between Christ and the founders of empires and the gods of other religions, but that resemblance does not exist. There is between Christianity and any other religion the distance of infinity. Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and myself have founded empires, but upon what did we rest the creations of our geniuses? Upon force. Jesus Christ alone founded His empire upon love, and at this hour, millions and millions of men would die for Him." Napoleon wished that he had that kind of devotion from people that he had created his empire from, of course. Jesus had no wealth. Not only did it not have a stately appearance, but Jesus had no wealth with which to launch anything significant. There was nothing about what he had in terms of this world's goods that would make him someone interesting to anyone else. He was reared in one of the most despised communities of the country. To say, is there anything good that can come out of Nazareth, was something everybody understood. The answer to that was, nothing good has ever come out of a place like that. That was a proverb in Canaan. Jesus didn't even have any formal education. He didn't have formal rabbinical training with which he could mesmerize the multitudes of people that would come and listen to him. And even his own people had a little regard for him because of that. They didn't listen to him. He came to his own, But his own would not receive him because he had no credential. He had no sheepskin to hang on the wall. He was not a degreed professor. But somehow or another, he changed the world forever. Maybe some of you have heard of a fellow by the name of Phillips Brooks. He wrote a hymn called O Little Town of Bethlehem, but this is something else that he wrote. He said he was born in an obscure village, the child of a peasant woman. He grew up in another village where he worked in a carpenter shop until he was 30 years old. And then for 3 years he was an itinerant preacher. He never wrote a book. He never held any office. He never had a family. He never owned a home. He didn't go to college. He never visited a big city. Jerusalem was the biggest he ever went to. He never traveled 200 miles from the place where he was born. He did none of the things that usually accompany greatness. He had no credentials but himself. He was only 33 years old when the tide of public opinion turned against him. His friends all ran away. One of them ended up denying him. He was turned over to his enemies and went through the mockery of a trial. He was nailed to a cross between two thieves. And while he was dying, his executioners gambled for his garments, the only physical property he had on earth. And when he was dead, he was laid in a borrowed grave through the pity of a friend. And 19 centuries have come and gone, and today he is the central figure of the human race. All of the armies that ever marched, all of the navies that ever sailed, all the parliaments that ever sat, all the kings that ever reigned, put together, have not affected the life of man on this earth as much as that one solitary life. I don't know how to improve on words that a guy would write like that, so I use his to tell you that that's exactly why Jesus was such an extraordinary figure. It was a common ideology and practice in the Roman world to tolerate all kinds of philosophies. Romans prided themselves on being very open-minded, very broad-minded, very tolerant of all sorts of ideas and philosophies. The historian Edward Gibbon, who of course wrote that famous series of books on the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, he observed that in the world of the Caesars, most different and even hostile nations embraced or at least respected each other's superstitions, and Rome was the leader in that regard. But, you know, Christians in the Roman Empire did not have that same attitude. Christians were narrow-minded. Christians were pretty intolerant of all of the philosophies and the ideologies of other people that were around them. They did not just go with the flow. They had some very strong monotheistic convictions, and they refused to participate in the pagan rituals that saturated every pore of heathen culture in that day. They flexed their spiritual muscles as often as they could, and they would not bow down to the pressures of paganism. They taught that redemptive truth was associated exclusively and only with Jesus of Nazareth. They had a one Lord, one faith, one baptism mentality, and they drew a line in the sand when it came to matters of faith, which they did not compromise with the rest of the Roman world. But what were the Romans doing while the Christians were standing for the truth? Well, they were catering to the basest of human passions. Drunkenness was rampant in the Roman Empire. Sexual indulgence was just the order of the day, even as a religious ritual. They used these sorts of things. Sacred temples that were scattered across the Roman Empire were really virtual houses of prostitution. One ancient geographer by the name of Strabo has said that in Corinth there were 1,000 priestesses who served in the temple of Aphrodite, and one of the chief sources of revenue in the city of Corinth was the prostitution that these 1,000 priestesses engaged in that brought in all sorts of revenue for that city. In more modern times, think about how many Islamic armies have been mustered under the promise that if you'll lose your life in this sacred cause, that you'll be carried away to a sensual paradise adorned with all these dark-eyed beauties that are just waiting for you to show up. And that's caused a lot of men to go to their deaths because they were looking for something sensual and sexual as their motivation and their reward for doing what they did. Christians didn't promise things like that. Christianity, from the very earliest days, went against the grain of the society at large. They forbade all sexual activity except those that were authorized within the bounds of monogamous heterosexual marriage. In fact, you read Paul's 1 Corinthians letter, it emphasizes that matter repeatedly. And so what we have is we have Christianity in the first century constantly challenging everybody else's lifestyle around them. And yet they were so successful. I think we need to stop and realize we're not the first Christians that have ever had to swim upstream when it came to the mores of the society around us. We sometimes get discouraged. Well, there's no use in us preaching the truth. Nobody's going to listen to that. We're not going to be successful with that. People are determined that they're going to live ungodly and immoral lives, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse. Well, yes, I know it's seemingly getting worse, but let me tell you, Christianity was swimming upstream in the world in which it originated, and it was crying out against all those ungodly things that you and I see going on in the licentious lifestyles of people today. And yet they were successful at doing what God put them there to do. And I will tell you that the only way that could happen is if it were a divine movement. If it was God that was behind it and God that was pushing it forward. Being a Christian was a dangerous thing to be in the Roman world. Christianity was barely launched when persecution became a bloody reality for our brethren of the first century. You think about just what you read in the book of Acts, the somber picture of violence that was inflicted upon new believers almost from the beginning. Acts chapter 4, two apostles, Peter and John, get thrown into prison. In Acts chapter 5, we see them in prison. In Acts chapter 7, we read about Stephen being stoned. We read in Acts chapter 12 about James, the apostle, being killed with the sword. Some of the persecution Paul endured is vividly summarized for us in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. And it was Tertullian himself who would later on say that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the kingdom. He believed that the persecutions that they endured was what propelled them. It was what caused the movement to grow. It was what caused the Christian regime to flourish. In the year 112, Pliny, who was the governor of Bithynia, had to make a report to the Roman Emperor Trajan, whom he served. And he was inquiring, of course, as to what he should do about the Christians that were in his area. And in that letter he wrote to the emperor, he detailed what he would customarily do to Christians. He said, "I ask them if they are Christians, and if they admit it, I repeat the question a second and a third time, and I threaten them with capital punishment, and if they persist, I sentence them to death." That was in the year 112. That was right at the turn of the second century. Tertullian noted that the Christians were not even afforded the benefits of a trial, as a common criminal would have been afforded in the Roman Empire. The demanding question that this has to raise is, why would multiplied thousands suffer themselves to be so abused, to be stoned and decapitated, and sometimes just sewn up into animal skins and thrown to wild beasts? Why would they allow themselves to be crucified or burned alive? Was it all for a myth? Was it because they just had a hunch that this might be some substantive religion that they had stumbled upon? I believe the incredible conclusion we have to reach is the fact that these were people who were doing what God had orchestrated and demanded that they do. Every effect must have an adequate cause. And what possible natural explanation is there for all the things that we've talked about tonight? I don't believe there is one. I believe that Christianity is of divine origin because it was the product of the Son of God Himself, who said upon this fundamental truth that I am the Christ, the Son of the living God, I will build my church. And when we consider all of that, I have to think about all the things that God must be expecting of me. And all the things that God must be expecting of you and our generation, under our circumstances, to herald the truth and to spread the gospel to a world that is remarkably similar to the world of the first century when the church first appeared. Christianity is anchored, folks, in real history. In fact, it's impossible for us to talk about our Christian roots and not talk about a lot of historical things. You can check all the facts, and you can embrace Christian faith with confidence, and you can obediently surrender to it, and you can entertain all the blessings that are associated with it, because it was not from men. It was from heaven for men who needed a Savior. And we owe that to the grace and the mercy of Almighty God, who stepped in when man was lost and undone and could do nothing for himself and provided for us that which we would never, ever have been able to originate on our own. I realize this lesson tonight is a little different than what we might ordinarily experience, but I think sometimes it's good to step back and to recognize, as you look at our faith from the viewpoint of the world, there are all sorts of connections to the histories of peoples that encountered Christians and had to deal with the faith that Jesus came to establish. And in a pluralistic society like we live in, where most of us are being told day by day that one religion is just as good as another, and that all religions are equally right, it's good for us to stop and recognize that's not true. It never has been true, not since AD 30, when Jesus came to establish His church. I'm thankful to be a part of it. I'm humbled by that. And it makes me recognize that my feeble attempts to serve the Lord have been predeceased by all sorts of people who gave their lives and did things that I've never had to do in order to be faithful to God. I'm grateful for the privilege of being a child of God. I want other people to be children of God. But I also want to appreciate the heritage from which we've come. And I hope I've impressed that on us tonight.